You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, December 6th, the feast day of St. Nicholas. St. Nicholas of Myra. We'll talk about him a little bit today, actually with my guest in the second hour, Jonathan Ryan, you know, one of the sort of historical accretions, let's just say. Because I'm not sure there's actual ancient historical proof of this, but certainly a legend grown up around St. Nicholas of him punching Arius or slapping Arius, one of the most prominent heretics in the early church, one who, I mean, for a good while there, won a lot of adherence even among bishops. Arius, who reduced the nature of Christ or could not embrace Christ's full divinity. Anyway, there's, you know, a legend about St. Nicholas, I guess meant to sort of dampen the image of him as simply a jolly old soul, of in defense of orthodoxy about the faith, planting a right cross across the face of Arius. We'll talk about that a little bit in the second hour with my guest, Jonathan Ryan. Jonathan, who blogs at the blog called Sick Pilgrim, which is really good, and he'll talk a little bit about the problem with punching a heretic. Of course, associated with that story of St. Nicholas is the fact that he was disciplined by his fellow bishops, but then received a divine visitation while he was in jail. But we'll talk about that a little bit, and if you found chocolate in your shoes this morning, you'll know that it is St. Nicholas Day. Anyway, we'll also talk with Jacob Lupfer in the second hour. Jacob, who writes for Religion News Service, is also a doctoral student in at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. I follow Jacob on Twitter, appreciate his writing. I think he tries to be very fair-minded. He himself, not Catholic, but I think very fair-minded of the Catholic Church, which, by the way, is dangerous. As Chesterton said, you know, the first step in becoming Catholic is being fair to the Catholic Church, because once you're fair, it's not long before you become fond of it. And as someone who speaks from personal experience, I can attest there's a lot of truth there. But I'll have to ask Jacob about that, probably off air. But we're going to talk about a column he wrote about when is the appropriate time to start listening to Christmas music. And he lays out the four schools of thought among the Christmas music debaters. And so we'll get into that. By the way, my wife and I are in different schools of thought about that. But that's what makes marriage interesting, doesn't it? When we don't see eye to eye. I mean, the way I look at it, there's my wife's way of looking at things, and then there's the right way of looking at things. So just don't tell her I said that. 5734-BREAD-4, 5734-BREAD-4, always the number to call or text if you want to chime in. Put in your 2 cents into the program, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or post a response on Facebook or on Twitter, and I'll give you the question of the day in the next segment. Some other things we'll talk about today is Advent and presumption, why love outlasts judgment, a little bit more on Trump and Taiwan, and my annual limited defense of the song Mary, Did You Know? I will also spin the Dalek Catechism wheel, look back in history, and give out our What Were You Thinking awards, all that and more yet to come. The first reading today, taken from the book of Isaiah, chapter 40, verses 1 through 11. You know, the book of Isaiah is an interesting one. It's the longest of the biblical prophets, 66 chapters. It is the most quoted in the New Testament. Beautiful images of and allusions to a coming messianic ruler that, of course, the earliest Christians saw fulfilled in Jesus of Nazareth. But it's a book that does not begin lightly. If you go to the very beginning of Isaiah, in fact, really the first 39 chapters in many ways are interspersed with words of hope and yet also words of strong judgment. Judgment against a corruption and greed and false religion and all sorts of things that have come into the southern kingdom of Judah. You know, you had, I was funny, I was talking to a deacon who preached at my parish this past weekend. He's really an outstanding homilist, to be honest with you. But as part of his homily, he was talking about sort of the history of Israel and kingdoms, because he was his second Sunday of Advent. He was talking about John the Baptist, the voice crying in the wilderness and announcing the coming kingdom of the Lord. The kingdom of God is at hand. And he went through this whole litany of Israel's experience with kingdoms. Of course, the kingdom that they enjoyed for a brief season, a united kingdom with the temple filled with the glory of the Holy Spirit, really the high point of Israel's history from the time of the patriarchs, when Solomon built the temple and consecrated it and the Lord's presence filled it and so forth. And neighboring nations came to admire and stand in awe of Solomon and his riches and his wisdom. It's really the high moment. It was all downhill from there, so to speak, with the kingdom dividing into the northern and the southern kingdoms, and then constant threats from both without and within. For the northern kingdom, it was the Assyrians, the Assyrian armies who came in and ultimately conquered Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom. It was during this season that Isaiah was prophesying in the southern kingdom of Judah, observing what was happening in the north, and in essence, letting the people know that this was a preview of coming attractions in the south because of the Lord's anger and wrath against their disobedience, against their injustice, against their idolatry and infidelity. It's precisely the kind of message that made the role of a prophet not a coveted role. God usually had to grab prophets by the scruff of the neck, even despite their protestations, and call them to speak these words of truth. And they were harsh words. If you read the very beginning of Isaiah's book, you know, if you're used to reading like the letters of St. Paul that typically began with warm greetings and so forth, and you know, grace and peace and truth and so forth, Isaiah begins with just a scathing indictment. Sinful people laden with wickedness, evil offspring, corrupt children. They have forsaken the Lord, spurned the Holy One of Israel, apostatized. From the sole of the foot to the head, there is no sound spot in it. Just bruise and welt and oozing wound, not drained or bandaged or eased with salve. Your country is waste. Your cities burnt with fire. Even then, the southern kingdom trying to beat off the advance of the Assyrians. Of course, the southern kingdom would stand for about another, let's say maybe 135, 140 years until they fell themselves to the Babylonians, who had defeated the Assyrians and came in. And so, anyway, what I was saying this past Sunday, the deacon kind of walked through all these kingdoms, because then even after Babylon was defeated, you had the Persians, and then after the Persians, you had the Greeks, and then you had the Romans, and Israel had always lived under someone's thumb, right? And somebody, I guess, after his homily had said, "Thanks for the history lesson, Deacon." He wasn't sure how quite to take that, but history matters. You know, it helps to know these things, to give you a context for passages. And I'm saying that because the first reading for today is from Isaiah chapter 40, which is sometimes called Second Isaiah. You've got 66 chapters. Most biblical scholars say chapters 1 through 39 can be rightly attributed to Isaiah, who preached and proclaimed his message during the fall of the northern kingdom while in the southern kingdom, Jerusalem, at its capital. But that this begins chapter 40, a song of hope for those now who have been defeated and carried off into exile. That's one characteristic of the Old Testament prophets, is yes, they preached judgment, but it was always imbued with hope. They were never without hope. The chastisement of sorts that God was allowing would come to an end. And so you get this beautiful passage, chapter 40 in Isaiah, one of the beautiful chapters among all the prophets, Comfort, give comfort to my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her service is at an end. Her guilt is expiated. Indeed, she has received from the hand of the Lord double for all her sins. And then we have, of course, a voice cries out, in the desert, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the wasteland a highway for our God. Every valley shall be filled in. Every mountain and hill shall be made low. It's the beginning of a great section of hope. We'll read later in Isaiah about the servant to come, the servant on whom the Holy Spirit is given and who's anointed and who will suffer for the people. But it's just a reminder, I think, you know, during this Advent season and really during seasons of great hardship and suffering. Sometimes suffering we bring upon ourselves. Sometimes it's simply something from without, but that God, for whatever reason, chooses to allow. I'm reminded of that beautiful promise in Psalm 103 that says, he will not always accuse, and he nurses no lasting anger. He has not dealt with us as our sins merit, nor requited us as our wrongs deserve. I'm reminded of the beautiful truth of Advent, even as that those two little candles shine in the darkness, that God's love outlasts his wrath. God's love outlasts suffering. God's love endures forever, and it's never extinguished or quenched. So no matter what we're going through, note that our Lord has come into a world just like this. He's present to us now, and he will come again. And all this stuff, this suffering, God willing, will be no more. We'll be back with the question of the day. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Check out what we do at breadboxmedia.com, including the app that you can download for your smartphone. If you know somebody who's not quite technologically up to speed, someone like, say, like me, who has a smartphone and wants to know how to download the app, just give them a hand. It's pretty simple. Then all you got to do is touch the app, and you got Breadbox Media in your pocket. Enjoy all of our various contributors, each corner of this country and across the heartland. You can also listen to podcasts through Google Play, iTunes, or Podbean, subscribe, and all the rest. My question of the day for this Tuesday, I'm going to be talking with Jacob Lupfer in the second hour today about the appropriate time to start listening to Christmas music. Unless you wear earplugs all the time, you can hardly help hearing it this time of year. There are many secular radio stations that started playing Christmas music just before Halloween, so it's around. And, when you hear something a lot, you tend to form a love-hate relationship with it. And there are some Christmas songs like that. So my question is, what for you is the most cringeworthy Christmas song, whether sacred or secular? Simple enough question. Now, the interesting thing is sometimes one man's pleasure is another man's poison. We can have differences sometimes even in our own homes over what Christmas songs we like and don't like. Case in point, for my family and me, I happen to loathe the song Wonderful Christmas Time by Paul McCartney. Meanwhile, my wife and children love it. So it's a great act of purgation for me riding down the road when it comes on, because I'm compelled to leave it on the radio, even though it's a song that, for whatever reason, I can't hardly take. So anyway, but if you want to chime in on that question, 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4, you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. So let's go down the list here of some comments we've gotten on Facebook. You can do that as well, or on Twitter, Mike Allen Show, the handle. Joan says, you know my answer. And I know that her least favorite Christmas song is Christmas Shoes. That's part of the reason I put the graphic up of the red stiletto heels that I guess are the subject of the shoes named in the song. So red Christmas shoes, yeah, that song. I really don't need songs that are about horrible death anyway for Christmas, just saying. Kathy says, Grandma got run over by a reindeer. See, I kind of like that song. But Kathy's a grandma, so maybe she takes it personally. Leo says, are there any non-cringeworthy Christmas songs? Oh, absolutely. I love the Bing Crosby-David Bowie collaboration. Lisa says, Stevie Nicks' Silent Night. I don't think I've heard that one. AJ is a man after my own heart. He says, hands down, wonderful Christmas time. Andrew says, Last Christmas. Now, I want to warn you, just thinking about the song Last Christmas, whether it's the original Wham! Version or the T-Swizzle remake, will put an earworm in your head, because now I've got it. Last Christmas, I gave you my heart, but the very next day, you gave it away. Listen, it's that song, I've never heard. Maybe Feliz Navidad is more repetitive, but not by much. But it is the perfect Taylor Swift song, because I'd say it's fairly true to life. With each passing Christmas, she's given her heart to someone else and had it crushed and then written a hit song about it. Rebecca says Christmas Shoes. Christy, Jingle Bell Rock. Nah, I can go either way on that. Chelsea, my daughter, says Feliz Navidad. Mark says, Mary, Did You Know? Which, by the way, he says, why not simply ask her or do a little basic theological reflection? A little bit later in the show, I'm going to give you my annual limited defense of Mary, Did You Know? I'll share some more results a bit later in the program. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. Or you can chime in. Shannon sends me a message here. She says, Fat Santa parody. I don't think I've ever heard that one. Having a wonderful Christmas time. Yes. Last Christmas, Christmas Shoes. And that compilation, Feed the World. Yeah, the Live Aid or Band Aid or whatever it was. Feeding the hungry, starving children in Africa. Yeah, that song is leaves much to be desired as well. So chime in if you want. Sports-wise, big game last night for Splish. I had to ask Alex this morning which one was Splish and which one was Splash on the Golden State Warriors. Klay Thompson evidently is Splish. Splish rained down 60 on the Indiana Pacers last night. And so while there had been some questions early in the season whether Klay Thompson would be as featured a part of the offense with Mr. KD, Kevin Durant, on the squad, I guess he answered that question, scoring 60 points in less than 30 minutes of action last night. The Warriors continue to roll. It looks like that opening hiccup game is sort of a distant memory. Now, I don't think they'll match last year's 73 wins, but they're going to be loaded for bear. Part of the reason is that the NBA West, I think, is so tough, for sure. Football last night, the New York Jets continue their downward spiral, hammered at the hands of the, oh my goodness, who was that won last night? Alex, I'm blanking out. Oh, the Colts. Yeah, Andrew Luck back. Colts now back into playoff contention in the pretty mediocre AFC South, for sure. Let's see. College football, of course, continues to be a lot of buzz about the four-team playoff. Those look to be some good games, Alabama, Washington, Clemson, Ohio State, particularly that Clemson, Ohio State. If memory serves me correctly, it was the last time Clemson and Ohio State played the Woody Hayes punch game. I think it may have been back in the late 70s. I remember watching that game. I think it was maybe in the Gator Bowl. Clemson, Ohio State, and Clemson got intercepted, Ohio State quarterback, and ended up running out of bounds on the Ohio State sideline, and legendary Buckeyes coach Woody Hayes started waylaying him on, I guess, pulling a St. Nicholas on Arius. Started slugging him. That was the end of a storied career. So I think that may be the first time they've played since then. I'll have to do a little checking on that. But Neil Payne with an article in 538.com, my website that you hear me reference a lot, that looks at things through a statistical lens. It says, sorry, Penn State, the four best teams got into the college football playoff. And 538, doing a little bit of self-congratulating back patting when they say that they, of course, predicted that no matter what happened in the Big Ten championship game, that the Big Ten was solid and the chances of the winner of Penn State, Wisconsin getting in, assuming that the Pac-12 game was won by Washington, were slim, and it turned out to be the case. One of the things they point out is overlooked in all the arguing about who should get in is the potential legacy of Alabama here. Alabama, they use this thing at 538 called the ELO rating. They say Alabama has secured the greatest peak ELO rating by a college football team in the last 80 years when they crushed Florida 54-16 to win the SEC. So the case that they're making, among other cases in this piece, is that should Alabama go on to win the national championship convincingly, they can stake a claim not just to the championship this year, not just Nick Saban's fifth in his last 8 years, which is a mind-boggling figure, but they can stake a claim to being the greatest college football team of all time. It'd be hard to argue. I think Penn State has a fairly nice consolation prize. The other big news yesterday, Leonard Fournette, probably shocking no one, announcing he would bypass his senior season to enter the NFL draft. Now, here's the thing about Leonard Fournette, in my opinion. Leonard Fournette, who is likely to be the number one, maybe the number two pick in the NFL draft, has, you know, he I don't think played the last game with a tweaked ankle. Leonard Fournette has no business playing in LSU's bowl game. I'll say it. Yes, purists, you throw all the hate you want, but Leonard Fournette will gain nothing from playing for LSU in a bowl game and stands to risk a tremendous payday. I don't see how any rational person, I don't care how much competitive machismo you want to throw my way about, you know, it's his duty and blah, blah, blah. Leonard Fournette has no duty to play in a meaningless bowl game for LSU. Leonard Fournette has a duty to Leonard Fournette in this situation and to his family and for all those who, you know, who are depending on Leonard Fournette having a great career, his future family, all the rest. And I think you're going to start seeing this more and more. And I personally have no problem with it at all. Once a player has established his draft status, if he's playing in a game that means nothing in terms of national championship race, certainly if he wants to play, he can, but he's under no obligation. Too much risk, I think. Too much money involved, in my opinion. All right, let's see if we can sneak in one What Were You Thinking award here before we get to the break. Again, go dumb or go home. This is a story of a grandmother who was pulled over recently with, I think, two trays of marijuana-laced brownies in her possession. Is this really the kind of story that we want to hear? I mean, grandmas are for cookies and hot apple cider, not being pulled over and someone finding 2 pounds of pot brownies in their car. I know it's a new day and a new age, but Norma Jean Francie, come on, you need to go back to your Grandma 101 book. We'll be back with more. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Mm-hmm. right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on Redbox Media. You want to support your favorite show? Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Just go to redboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show, and you can find out how through monthly support you can provide and help your favorite show continue on the air and continue going strong. You can also receive access to exclusive online content and all the rest. Check it all out. 573-4BREAD-4. If you want to chime in, what is a Christmas song that you find particularly cringeworthy? Maybe there's disagreement in your home. That's perfectly okay. But, you know, maybe some love a song and some hate a song. I know one I saw that got mentioned was, another old Lang Syne, the Dan Fogelberg. My old lover, talk about a depressing song. Ends up on Christmas Eve putting away a six-pack in a car with his former young love, who drives away drunk while he staggers out into the snow. Does anybody wonder where he is? <That's real. laughs> I will say I like the sax solo at the end. I'll give the song that. So chime in on that if you want. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Back to that story for just a minute about the grandmother with the marijuana brownies. The first nominee of a What Were You Thinking Award, Norma Jean Francie, 61, of San Diego, when she was pulled over for running a stop sign, had 2 pounds of marijuana-laced brownies individually packaged in 21 plastic bags in her trunk, as well as 2 ounces of marijuana. The trooper who pulled her over said he noticed a strong odor of marijuana in the car. And the woman told the trooper she had just visited her sister-in-law in Mount Pleasant and was on her way to Johnstown, noting she became nervous and emotional as he spoke to her. I asked Francie what was wrong, the officer said, and she related she hadn't seen her grandkids in a long time, and it was traveling to visit her son and grandkids. When they found the brownies, they asked Francie if there was marijuana in there. She said, yes, there is. She related she ate the brownies to help her sleep. Like I said, not typically what you imagine grandma bringing along. But again, as I said, I guess it's a new day. All right. Our second nominee in the What Were You Thinking Award, we're going to give to Amazon.com over in Great Britain. I saw this headline. Let's see. Amazon yanks a la doormats after complaint. So when I saw the headlines, I thought, oh, okay, there are citizens who are upset about the acceptance, toleration of Muslims among them, and so they're offended by there being doormats with the word Allah on them. But turns out the complaints actually were from Muslims who were offended by the idea of wiping their feet on the name of God. And the more I thought about it, I thought, yeah, who came up with this idea? Because not only were they selling an Arabic doormat with the name Allah, which, by the way, just so you know, the name Allah is simply the Arabic word for God. So if you are a Catholic living in the Middle East and that's your native language is Arabic, then you're calling God Allah. Doesn't mean you're Muslim. So let's get that out of the way. And number two, they not only sell a welcome mat with Allah written on it, they also sell a dog mat with Allah written on it that I'm assuming dogs can use to, take care of business. So whoever decided, you know, that was a good idea to wipe your feet on the name of God, probably not a good marketing ploy. But the winner... We're going to give the winner of the award to a Virginia school district. Accomack County in Virginia has suspended Harper Lee's novel To Kill a Mockingbird, as well as The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, from classrooms and libraries after a parent's complaint.
To Kill a Mockingbird and The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn have been suspended from the curriculum in some Virginia schools after a parent complained about the use of racial slurs. At the center of the complaint was the use of the N-word, which appears frequently in both titles. The woman who made the complaint said her son struggled to read the racist language, telling the public school board, "There's so much racial slurs and defensive wording in there, you can't get past that." Well, maybe some can't get past that, but that's really, I mean, both books, particularly To Kill a Mockingbird, if anything, is a rejection of racism. And yeah, you got to kind of be willing to enter into that world. It's you know, it's kind of like those who can't get past certain things, for example, that maybe in a movie or something. I'm not saying that there aren't gratuitous, there isn't gratuitous stuff in movies that's, you know, completely unnecessary, but, you know, oftentimes you will find profound truth sometimes hidden within the honest portrayal of realities in our world. That's all. Whoever decided it was a good idea to remove To Kill a Mockingbird, please, you get our What Were You Thinking award, and hopefully you'll come to your senses soon enough. If you've got a nominee or maybe a story even from your own life, we always like, we'll be laughing with you, not at you. Trust me. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Would love to hear from you on that. Send it my way. You know, there's still continued talk about Donald Trump and the situation with Taiwan, the phone call that he took. Of course, there's a lot of arguing both sides. Those who say it was a masterfully strategic move by Donald Trump. We talked about this a little bit yesterday, to take the phone call from the Taiwanese president as a sign that China's not going to kick us around anymore. That, you know, that China doesn't determine who we talk to and who we don't talk to. And therefore, you know, they don't like it. They can just deal with it. On the other hand, there are those who say this is just evidence of Donald Trump's naivete, his ignorance of foreign policy issues. And it's one thing to portray a certain machismo, a certain toughness, and so forth. But if you don't weigh the ramifications of your every action, this is just an evidence of the fact that Donald Trump doesn't know what he's doing and could provoke diplomatic crises. But then you've got now a third school of thought emerging that, you know, it's really not that big of a deal. In fact, President Obama's, I think, one of his top advisors, former national security advisor, I believe, kind of gave it one big meh. Meh primarily because there's a difference between what you do as president and what you do as president-elect. And so there would be a much bigger deal if Donald Trump took a phone call from Taiwan and went public about it when he's actually inaugurated and in the Oval Office. So, I gave out my kudos to Donald Trump because I get weary of always kowtowing, always couching things. But at the same time, I guess we just kind of have to wait and see what the ramifications of this are. And, you know, I hope that Donald Trump is able to weigh. Sometimes your ego, you feel like you've got gut instincts that are good. I mean, they got you the White House. But there are times in which your gut instincts are wrong. I hope that soon-to-be President Trump will have the wherewithal to be able to recognize that there are times that he needs to lean upon his advisors, and that his advisors will have the freedom to speak the truth to him in terms of what they see as the ramifications of certain things. That's my only concern with the Donald. Sometimes I think the Donald's ego can get in the way, and he's more interested in being right than in doing the right thing. So, and believe me, the reason I recognize that trait, because I know it's true of me as well. Anyway, back to our question of the day. What is the Christmas song that you find to be most cringeworthy? David tweets in at Mike Allen Show, "So This Is Christmas by John Lennon. Worst Christmas song ever." Yeah, that's not a good one. I'll give you that. Some other remarks I've gotten on here. Let's see. Shannon remarks about the What Were You Thinking Award. She said, "I guess the parent has never read Huck Finn or To Kill a Mockingbird before." I'd say there's a high chance of that if they're complaining against it. Let's see. Alan comments on the question of the day and says that the song "I Want a Hippopotamus for Christmas." He said that voice makes me want to hurt people. Don't do that, Alan. It's just a song, but I get it. There's some commercial that plays ad nauseum that has that song in it. Dana says she can't stand Maroon 5's version of "Happy Christmas, War Is Over." But another Auld Lang Syne gets her vote. And let's see. Yeah, another comment on "Mary, Did You Know." So I'll give you my limited defense of that song when we come back from the break. It's limited, but it is a defense. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Ten minutes before the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show.
Welcome in here on this feast day of St. Nicholas of Myra, Bishop of Myra, who allegedly, according to some sources, slugged Arius, the heretic, in the face. We'll talk to Jonathan Ryan about that in the second hour. We'll also talk with Jonathan Lupfer, who writes for Religion News Service, about the arguments for and against listening to early Christmas music. So we'll get into all that. Again, my question of the day, what is the most cringeworthy Christmas song in your opinion? You know, the stuff that you hear and want to drive your car into a ditch. Meanwhile, somebody else in your car probably is saying, "Leave it on, leave it on. Love this song." What song is it? 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Let's look back at history a little bit on this date, see some other things that have happened. December 6th, 1790, Congress moved from New York City to Philadelphia. Obviously, be a short time there in the city of brotherly love before heading to D.C. 1862, U.S. President Lincoln ordered the hanging of 39 Santee Sioux Indians. Just reading a little bit about this. There were actually 300 or more Santee Sioux Indians who were in revolt, and probably for good reason, but who had murdered a good number of white settlers. Anyway, President Lincoln evidently examined the case because it was brought to him, this order of 300 executions. He ended up poring over each case individually, even in the midst of such a great national crisis as the Civil War, and called out which of the 39 were deserving of execution in his mind and which should be set free. So, yes, a great act of execution violence, but also of clemency on the part of the president as well. In 1865, the 13th Amendment of the Constitution ratified, abolishing slavery. James J. Braddock, born on this day in 1905, I believe lived into the 1970s, the subject of one of my favorite movies, Cinderella Man. In 1907, the worst mining disaster in U.S. history occurred as 362 men and boys died in a coal mine explosion in Monongah, West Virginia.
1923, a presidential address broadcast on radio for the first time as Calvin Coolidge spoke to a joint session of Congress. 1947, the Everglades was dedicated. I was reading about a threat to the Everglades the other day. It's Burmese pythons, believe it or not, that were introduced by, I guess, someone letting a pet loose. Now they've infiltrated the Everglades to devastating effect. That's also very, very creepy, by the way. In 1950, interestingly enough, Pope Pius XII published his encyclical Mirabile Iliud. And what it essentially was, it was a call on the vigil of the Immaculate Conception, which would have been just the next day, that at midnight, actually on December 8th, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, he as the Holy Father would be offering a Mass that would be broadcast, and he invited everyone in the world to unite their prayers with his for peace. Now, a little context. Recall, this is only 5 years removed from the end of World War II hostilities and the devastation and bloodshed, which was still fresh in everyone's mind and still evident in the rebuilding going on in Europe and the Pacific and other places. But you had also had the conflict emerge in Korea, in which the United States and other United Nations forces had entered in response to the invasion of the North into the South. Plus, you had the specter of nuclear war looming over the whole thing. And Pope Pius XII doing really what popes do better than anybody, and that's call people together, acknowledging the power of prayer to prevent the world from being destroyed and to bring about peace, a real peace, particularly during a time of Advent when we think of the Prince of Peace. So that was pretty cool to come across that little historical tidbit, and hard to put ourselves back in that time period, of course, before I was born, but the tensions that must have been present. 1964, 52 years ago, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer first aired on TV. Bumbles Bounce! Oh, what a great movie. And the Claymation special. And then Johnny Manziel, 24 years old today. Oh, Johnny. Have some grape juice or something, man. Cut off the hard stuff. Maybe you can find your way back to the NFL. So those are some things that happened on this day. I did want to, you know, we're talking about Christmas music. What is the most currently, what is the most cringeworthy Christmas song? And there are some who put Mary, Did You Know? And this is the time of year. And I think I talk about this just about every year. But this is the season in which, on social media in particular, you're going to find a lot of sort of snarky comments, particularly from Catholics, about this song. Now, I understand, believe me, I understand the snark. I've laid out, dished out my own share of snark on social media. It's a very conducive environment for that. And particularly as a Catholic, we are pretty defensive about the Blessed Mother, as any good child should be when their mamas, when they feel like their mamas doesn't get the due that she deserves. And so, you know, not only the sort of ignoring of the Blessed Mother by Protestant Christians who tend to break her out of mothballs once a year for their nativity sets, but, you know, also any sort of attempt to denigrate her immaculate nature and so forth, there tends to be a defensiveness. So when a song like Mary, Did You Know comes out that has been very popular, not just in Protestant circles, it's been popular in Catholic circles. Believe me, I've heard it sung in more than one Catholic church over the years. Catholics get a little bit bowed up about it, and particularly the implication of the song that there were things somehow that Mary did not know. And usually the sort of snarky comments are comprised of something like, Mary, did you know? The answer is yes. Next question. Or something denigrating like that. And, you know, usually it makes the list of the worst Christmas songs, and particularly among Catholics and so forth. Meanwhile, there are many Protestants who are sort of incredulous. I've seen this. I've got a good friend who he kind of makes it, it's his own little cottage industry to sort of gig Catholics on social media, but he's sort of put off by the snarkiness from Catholics about this song.
And there's a whole thread going on his wall right now about it. And here's where I'm going to say, this is my limited defense of Mary, Did You Know? Because, you know, basically, if you're not familiar with the song, which would be amazing if maybe you've been living in a cave with squirrel run power, I don't know. Mary, did you know that your baby boy would one day walk on water? Mary, did you know that your baby boy would save our sons and daughters? Did you know that your baby boy has come to make you new? The child that you delivered will soon deliver you. It goes on from there that your baby boy will give sight to a blind man, will calm the storm with his hand. Did you know that he's walked where angels trod? See, usually what Catholics do with this song is, number one, they take it very, very literally, as though this is a serious question being asked of Mary. I don't see it that way. I see it more of a rhetorical, contemplative meditation. The few of them you can say with certainty, yes, of course, Mary knew that. The angel told her that explicitly, for example. There are other things that I don't think we necessarily have to say we know Mary knew. Things that would have required omniscience from her, and Mary was not omniscient. She was a human person. She's the prototype of the redeemed. She saved in a unique act of God's grace, preserved free from the stain of original sin. But there were things that she didn't know, and I think there are indications in the Gospels. There were things that she didn't know, things that she learned as she went along, that she contemplated in her heart. And so I guess this is almost the question, you know, are you an idealist to where you say, look, if there's anything misleading about Mary here, then the song should be expunged from the Christmas canon? Or can you say, you know what, here is a song written by Protestants, appreciated by Protestants, that involves a reflection about the Blessed Mother? To me, it's hard to see how that's a bad thing. Now, if you find the tune cheesy or annoying because you've heard it so much, that's one thing. But to get into a throwdown over the theological content of the song Mary, Did You Know, I think misses an opportunity. I mean, if we want Marian piety to grow among our baptized brothers and sisters, I don't think that even their incomplete attempts to appreciate and to reflect upon Mary's participatory role in the redemption of the world should be met by a snarky slapdown from Catholics. That's my opinion. You can tell me otherwise if you feel differently. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. So I probably said, you know, all the controversy I caused during the election season probably amount to nothing compared to a limited defense of Mary, Did You Know? But that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. We'll be back with a new hour, including a conversation with Jonathan Ryan and Jacob Lupfer. This is The Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.